today, we look back on this summer 50 years ago and the Democratic National Convention that went off the rails and into history.
And as long as I'm mayor of this town, there'll be law and order in Chicago.
Also, Cartemquin filmmaker Steve James joins us to talk about his new 10-part docuseries, America to Me. It follows a year in the life of high schoolers from Oak Park and River Forest communities.
People don't really engage in really candid and honest conversations about their real feelings about race because people worry so much about how they will come off if they say something that's at all critical or could be perceived negatively.
Why do we still struggle to talk about race openly, even in our, quote, diverse communities? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st.
Fellow delegates, the people of America are watching us now, as indeed the whole world is watching us.
Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and in that archival audio from YouTube, that's Georgia Delegate Julian Bond addressing the inside of the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. But it's those cries from protesters outside that are foremost in people's memories from that summer 50 years ago in Chicago. That's when discontent over the course of American politics, both at home and with the Vietnam War, drew 10,000 protesters to Chicago. And their clash with Chicago police is an event of such historical significance that today we wanted to look back at those events that happened 50 years ago this weekend. And to do that, in studio with me here in Urbana is historian Marcia Barrett, who teaches history at the University of Illinois. Hi, Marcia. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
And on the line with me from Chicago is veteran columnist and journalist Rick Kogan with the Chicago Tribune. Hello, friend. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello, old friend. And veteran is the word, the operative word. I feel so old now having to recall this in print. And now for you, Nyla, but I'd do anything for you.
Thank you, Rick. So when we think about this Sunday, it's such a big day in Illinois history. We were talking yesterday about how this Sunday is the 200th anniversary of our state constitution. So if we count backwards, in 1968, the opening day of the Democratic National Convention would have been the 150th anniversary of our state constitution. You were remembering this as four insane days. What was it like, I wonder? Can you tell us what the days were like leading up to the convention?
Well, because I lived in and was with my parents, of course, in Old Town as a teenager, I was sort of privy to what was going on a few blocks east in Lincoln Park, and as a curious kid, I would wander over there and see, wait a minute, why are all these people seemingly living in Lincoln Park? That is where many of the protesters who arrived in Chicago without any other place to stay had decided to sort of camp. And I think the night that they got kicked out, which I think was the night before the convention started, by the police department is really, really what kind of sparked everything that followed. Had they been, an old mutual friend of ours, Abe Peck, a former professor at Northwestern, who was then the editor of The Seed, had been petitioning to allow people to sleep in the park past the curfew and got rejected and rejected and rejected by Daley. And then Daley moved in the cops to move everybody out. And it was that night was absolute chaos that actually rivaled the night of the 28th in front of the Hilton.
Marcia, can you set for us the context of all of this? Rick is also talking about the immediate spark to this. But 1968, when we look back on American history, we're not just talking about the escalation of the Vietnam War. I wonder if we can go back a couple months prior to the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, and then before that, the assassination of Dr. King?
Right. You really can't overstate how tumultuous the year was, 1968. Earlier in the year, President Lyndon Johnson shocked many people in the nation when he announced that he would not run for re-election. And then on April 4th, you had the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. 2 months later, the assassination of Robert Kennedy. The nation was in shock, certainly, the Democratic Party in particular. But also after the assassination of King, you had urban unrest also known as riots, in over 100 cities across the country in April of 1968, and Chicago was one of those cities. So when we think about the tension in the city and the police and National Guard sort of preparation for the convention, we have to think that just a few months prior, you had a huge amount of violence that took place in Chicago, and there's already a lot of tension because of that. And then you add this growing discontent over the Vietnam War, and you end up having this really tense situation, and you have Mayor Daley, who is determined to demonstrate that he has control over the city, law and order, as he called it. And, you know, this sort of creates this very tense situation that delegates entered into when they came to the city of Chicago.
And Rick, what was that like with Mayor Daley and the police?
Well, that's very well put, because I think the tumult and fires and rioting in the wake of the assassination of Dr. King is what put the cops who were out there. And we have to remember, this is 50 years ago. They were out there, and I'm not defending them, but they were out there with no bulletproof vests, with no rifles, with no radios. That was life-altering for these people, many of whom at the time, including Ed Burke, the longest-serving alderman in the history of the city. It made them unbelievably tense, because Daley's whole notion, he was fearful that the riots would start to engulf the city. And because Chicago has a kind of natural moat, his plan was to put up all of the bridges across the Chicago River to prevent people from invading downtown. I cannot even imagine what the kind of stress that was involved for the cops, as sad and tragic as it was. These guys, all of them, and women, what few women were on the force then, were terrified. And I think you're very, very right that made all police officers and National Guard people in Chicago increasingly tense as we got up to the convention. I cannot punctuate that more forcefully. I think that contributed greatly to the chaos and the energetic attacks against the kids.
And Rick, I wonder if you can describe a little bit like what the convention. So at this point in time, you are a teenager, but you were you doing a little bit of work for the Sun-Times?
Yes, I was sort of a glorified copy boy, manning the phones and running errands for the reporters from the Sun-Times and the Daily News who were headquartered in the basement of the Hilton Hotel on Michigan Avenue. Mm. I did, the day before the convention, get to go down and see the amphitheater on the south side, 43rd and Halsted, where the convention was going to be held, and where there was great fear that people would protest around there. Impossible. It was like, it is unlike anything I've ever seen in the city of Chicago. It was like a guarded camp. Barbed wire for a square mile around the amphitheater were various checkpoints with barbed wire and National Guard people with rifles and Chicago police officer. Just getting to the amphitheater was nightmarish, I thought. And I think, I'm pretty sure I hazard to say that many delegates coming to Chicago, ooh, what a fun town, were shocked and appalled by that.
And Marcia, the irony of all of this, as we're remembering this is the Democratic National Convention. This is supposed to be a celebration of democracy where the party picks their president. I wonder how much of the, I mean, at the time, I think we look back on that with so much irony, but I wonder what the sense was in the moment of just this convention and how important this 68 convention was for the Democratic Party.
Well, I think that point about delegates arriving, right, and trying to enter the amphitheater and you seeing the barbed wire and all of the soldiers, I think that, I mean, that had to make a real impression on, on the delegates, but also this sense that, that all of this effort is needed to sort of remove delegates from rank and file and activists. who they hope to really incorporate into the party, I think must have been very striking, even though at that point it was still customary for party professionals to have a really tight control over Democratic conventions in this time period. It's sometimes described as, a bunch of middle-class white men sort of, monitoring this choreographed good time. But even for those who are accustomed to that, it must have been shocking.
And Rick, what was it like? So then I wonder if you can explain for folks how everything sort of broke down. You set up the beginning of the chaos, and that was that there were, what, maybe 10,000 people who had come to Chicago, quite a few thousand of whom were even more than that,
sure.
You think?
There were some locals, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think, the other thing about it as an observer of it, I mean, there were also a lot of curiosity seekers. I knew people, especially on the Wednesday night that the things exploded, the 29th here, when the real whole world was watching.
That was outside the Hilton.
That was right outside the Hilton when thousands of people tried to storm. I don't know if storm's the right word, but tried to get into the Hilton, and the police were there. I'll never forget standing behind a line of police. I was inside, standing behind a line of police in my father's old Marine Corps jacket and being looked at suspiciously because I looked much more like the kids in the street than I did the police officers. And I think what happened, and this is one man's observation, is that there was a lot of nastiness on both sides. There were ashtrays flying from windows in the Hilton. They were throwing down at police. There were things being thrown at cops. And all of a sudden, the cops seemed to overreact, and batons came out, and people scattered, and the air was filled with the saddest screams and bodies running and falling and blood. It is, in a sense, it was kind of, and I hate to use this kind of the comparison, but it was like sort of the worst barroom brawl for any of your listeners who know what a bar, how that kind of erupts. It simply erupted. It was disorganized chaos, and to anybody observing, and again, there were a lot of people down there who sort of actually had no business being down there. They were not police officers or National Guard folks or protesters. They were just curious, and a lot of those curious people got roughed up too. It was
and journalists,
wild,
right? Because there was also there's that famous video of Dan Rather getting on the convention floor, getting, as he says, belted in the stomach. And so all of this is also, right, Rick, all of this is being broadcast to all of America. And, this is the beginning of everyone really watching all of this. This is all being broadcast on TV. People are listening on the radio. I wonder, Marshall, let me ask you, what impact do you think this had? How did this change the Democratic Party?
You could point to a lot of different things in terms of the impact on the Democratic Party. But immediately, you do see a distinct difference in the 1972 convention. You had McGovern-Fraser reforms where the Democratic Party establishment decided that there needed to be some change, so that there would be more democracy, you could say, in the Democratic National Convention. So there was already an effort amongst young people, Black people especially, women, to be able to get more control over the Democratic Party before the 68 convention. But afterward, you start to see this momentum build. So there, just for an example, 5% of the delegates at the 1968 convention were Black. In 1972, it was 15%. I think there were 40% of the delegates in 1972 were women. That was triple the number of 1968. So you start to see more representation within the Democratic Party, where delegates begin to look more like Democratic voters. And the process of choosing delegates becomes more transparent. And these are efforts that were made to try to prevent this feeling on the convention floor that delegates and party establishment really had no connection to the voters and activists and issue-minded voters who weren't just willing to accept whoever the Democratic Party or the party professionals nominated. They wanted someone. They wanted to have a say. And you do see an immediate shift. One could even argue that Jimmy Carter, his nomination, winning the nomination in 1976, was due in part to those reforms and the inclusion of a more diverse delegate body in 76.
We just have about a minute or so left. Rick, I wanted to ask you how you think this changed not just Chicago, but maybe even a generation of Americans, maybe even yourself included, witnessing this?
I think it changed me in some sort of quiet ways. I certainly identified even at 16, I wanted the war to stop. But I also think we have to remember that that war, protest or no protest, went on for 7 more years, and countless thousands of young men mostly killed. Daley was indeed in Chicago and across this nation more popular than he had ever been, because I think the prevailing attitude, as much as we like to think this was a kind of us against them thing, most Americans did not even come close to feeling a part of the anti-war movement. It was these long hairs. The cultural clash was severe. Daley kept winning.
Right, because he was the law and order, right? And
that's right. It's like these kids, I think a lot of people, a lot of people thought, look at these spoiled, long-haired college, dope-smoking college kids. Good. Bust them in the head. And I really do believe it took years to overcome that, I think.
Right. Unfortunately, we're out of time, Rick, but I want to thank Rick Hogan, veteran Chicago journalist. He's with the Chicago Tribune, historian Marcia Barrett, for being with me. Both of you, thanks so much.
No, you two were great. Marcia,
thank you
were great. I don't know you. Take care.
Thank you very much.
The 21st is supported by the Champaign Hindu Temple, presenting Freedom Fest 2018, Saturday, August 25th at 11 a.m. This family festival celebrates the spirit of the Indian and American Independence Days with music, dancing, children's activities, and pan-Indian food. More information at champaignhindutemple.org.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Oak Park, this school is crazy. It's like a social experiment.
In this community, there are levels of diversity, but we mentioned race, all hell breaks loose.
That's part of the 10-part documentary series from Cartemquin Films called America to Me. It's a series exploring race, education, and high school through the lens of a handful of students who attend Oak Park and River Forest High School. Oak Park's a western suburb of Chicago bordering the city's Austin neighborhood. An award-winning filmmaker, Steve James, has turned his filmmaking eye from everything from Hoop Dreams to Roger Ebert's life, and he's the director and executive producer of the America to Me docuseries. On the line with us now from Oak Park to tell us more about it. Hi, Steve. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the 21st.
Yeah, great to be here.
So Chicago stories have been such a part of your career, but this is a docuseries about your community, Oak Park, River Forest. Was it hard for you to turn the camera on your own town?
Well, people have joked that, when the series comes out, where do I plan to move? But I think the portrayal of the high school and the community is balanced for sure. Yeah, it was tricky. I mean, for years, I've thought it would be interesting to look at this community and look at it through the high school to examine issues of race and achievement and how they play out in a liberal community where they still, nonetheless, have struggled around issues of equity. And so that was always the idea. I never thought it possible to do the film because I just figured the school would never allow us in. And then I found out a few years ago from John Conney, who's a teacher at the school and came on board as a producer, series producer, is that the decision about whether to make the series or make a film about the high school was really not up to the school itself. It's up to the school board, which is made up of community members. And And lo and behold, we were able to convince them to let us in.
Mm. And so I wanted to ask you about the name of the series, America to Me. This is a reference to Langston Hughes' poem, correct? Called Let America Be America Again?
Yes.
When did you first encounter that poem?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I heard the poem many, many years ago because it is a, you know, within his body of work, I think it is a considered one of his more significant poems. But I hadn't heard it in many, many years. And at some point when I was trying to sit down, we were well into making the series and didn't feel like we had a title, right? And so I started to really try to think about, well, what should the title of this series be? And, you know, one of the things you do when you're trying to come up with a title often is that you start to look at your own material and see if there's something in there that sort of jumps out as the title. And we did some of that, and nothing seemed to click. You know, for me, sometimes titles come very quickly and easily, and I even have them before the project started. For instance, Hoop Dreams was a title I had before we even shot anything. Or when I did the film The Interrupters, that was a title that I had before we even shot anything. But sometimes they're real labor to come up with. So in this case, I decided to start looking at poetry about the Black experience in America, you know, and see if there was something there that just would grab me. And when I revisited this poem, it really just, it grabbed me. And that phrase, America to me, within the poem, just really leaped out, in part because of how it reflects the overall meaning of the poem, but also because in this series, what we see this series as being at its heart is what is America today through the eyes of these kids that we are following, who are mostly in the film Black and biracial, and what is their America? And so we love the intimacy of that name, America to Me, as well as the sort of broader implications of what the series is about.
Right. And so the context of that poem, part of it is just Langston Hughes writing, I say it plain, America was never America to me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be. And to that point, as you're thinking, I do really think a lot of this is about identity, whether that's how the kids perceive themselves or how adults perceive them. And you follow a whole cast of different students throughout this 10-episode run. And in a school, I mean, Oak Park River Forest has got, what, more than 3,000 kids? How did you go about finding the central characters that you picked?
It was not easy. You know, I've never done a film before where I engaged in a kind of casting process like this. It's just not the way I've worked, but that was required here. And so John Conney, who I mentioned earlier, and I began getting the word out in the community that this series was something we were making and we were looking for subjects. He consulted with certain teachers to say, you know, if you have students that you think would be great for this, can you please pass on our information to them? And if they want to reach out, they reach out. And you know, in multiple ways, we went on Facebook, you know. And what it resulted in is that we conducted about 40 interviews with potential candidates and their families in the months over the summer leading into the beginning of production. And out of that, we selected 12 kids that we thought would be great candidates and then presented them to our larger creative team to kind of weigh in on. And from that, we picked 7 kids to start with. But I knew that we were going to want to pick up kids along the way and leave us the opportunity to do that. And so by the end of this series, we're following actually 12 kids.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then you also, most of the kids that you feature are predominantly African-American or biracial, but then there are also a few white students. Brendan and Caroline are a couple that are introduced. At what point did you realize you wanted to make sure that you had a couple different races presented in this?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. You know, Shayla Holland, who was the assistant principal at the school when we were trying to get the project underway and who was enormously insightful and influential in terms of our thinking about the series, she said to me at some point in the late spring, early summer, that if we really want, and this comment is basically in the series because we interviewed Shayla, you know, that if you really want to understand equity, you have to follow white kids, not just Black and biracial kids, that we're all part of the system. And so really it was her at her behest and influence that we started a process of trying to look for white kids as well. What was interesting about that is that we really didn't get that process earnestly underway, honestly, until right around the beginning of the school year. And I did not anticipate how difficult it would be to find a lot of candidates. I think what happened is...
The demographic makeup of the school is predominantly white, right?
Yeah, the school is 54% white. It's about 27% black, 9 to 10% Latino, and you know, whatever's left over, other. You know, I did not anticipate the difficulty that we would have with that. And in part, I think what happened is that, and we know because we heard this in different ways, is that there were, you know, a lot of white families at that point, they knew that this was a series that was going to look critically at equity and education in Oak Park. There's a lot of sensitivity around that. And I think that a lot of white parents felt like they didn't want to take the risk of being subjects in a series like this because that we might hold them up for ridicule in some way or as an example, as Caroline says at one point, who we do follow, she heard a student say, they're just going to hold you up as an example of white privilege. Like, why are you doing this? And, you know, that was not something, frankly, that I wanted to do at all. We wanted to treat the white subjects with the same care and empathy and understanding that we treat our black and biracial students. But there was that fear out there. And interestingly, we didn't really hear from anyone that I would say was really wealthy in the community. And there are a number of very wealthy white families in the community of Oak Park and especially River Forest as well. And I think especially there, people were like, I'm not going to have my lifestyle put on display in a series that's looking at these issues. You know, the thing about living in a liberal community is that people have a high level of awareness around how they look and how they speak about race, and that can make people extremely cautious. It's frankly one of the problems, I think, that happens in liberal America, which is that people don't really engage in really candid and honest conversations about their real feelings about race because people worry so much about how they will come off if they say something that's at all critical or could be perceived negatively.
My guest is Steve James. He's the director and executive producer of America to Me. It's a docuseries. It's actually premiering on Star starting this weekend. And to that point, Steve, I wanted to play a little clip from the series here. This is Glenn Singleton, and he speaks at conferences around the country. And you're going to hear part of that as well as his interview with you.
We sit in a country that really hasn't decided yet that it wants students of color to achieve at a high level.
I have to break it down. No, 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 no. When you get to Harvard, you now have Harvard racism. When you go to medical school, you get medical school racism. So that's why when Obama got elected, we started to know what presidential racism is.
What I've discovered about white liberal people is their liberalness only goes as far as when it starts to challenge their situation personally. That's the Oak Park River Forest community.
That's Glenn Singleton speaking to Steve James, who's the executive producer and director behind America to Me, a docuseries, as I mentioned, that's starting to air this weekend, a profile of the Oak Park River Forest, a suburban Chicago community. Steve, to that point, I wonder what you were just saying in terms of how hard it was to get some white families involved. This is an uncomfortable conversation for a lot of people, whether they're white or black or biracial or Asian. How tough was it to navigate through that?
Well, in my experience, and not just with this series, but a number of other films I've done that have grappled in differing ways with race in this country, starting with Hoop Dreams, but not just Hoop Dreams, I have found over the years that for many of the black people that I have encountered in the course of my filmmaking is that they don't have the same struggle or reticence about talking about race. And that, you know, I think is in part due to the fact that race is such as a primal and central part of their lived experience. And so they've had plenty of opportunity to not just deal with racism and deal with microaggression and all the things that go into being living in a contemporary society like the United States, but they also think about it a lot because they have to deal with it, and so they have a lot to say about it when you give them an opportunity to speak to it. And that's not true for a lot of white people in my experience. And some of that is, again, like I was saying earlier, some of that is, if you're liberal, is a reluctance to speak out for fear of saying the wrong thing, wanting to be say the right thing. Glenn Singleton said to me in the interview, this is not in the series, is that, you know, he is often found with his white friends, is that they are very fragile when it comes to discussions of race, that if he calls them on something that they've said and sort of says, you know, that's really kind of racist, they get really upset and hurt almost, and then he feels like he has to take care of them because they're friends, that they can't just sort of accept the fact that they have these blind spots and then engage with it in a candid and honest way, right? And I think that happens a lot in the white community. And then, of course, there are many of, you know, any time a white person tells you they have no racist attitudes at all, they're, in my view, they are not in touch with who they are. We all have them, no matter how liberal we may be. And I think that makes people very uncomfortable if they come to realize that. And of course, it manifests itself in really unproductive ways, I think, at times, which is that people then don't do anything. They feel like, you know, they'd rather do nothing and just live in a liberal place like Oak Park and feel like that's enough and try to harbor the right attitudes than actually actively go out and try and make real change.
And there's a line that is in one of the beginning episodes that diversity isn't the same thing as equity. And I wonder how much of this is about explaining that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, Oak Park is a very diverse community and it has enormous pride in its history around diversity and the ways in which it thwarted white flight and integrated rationally. And all that's, you know, rightfully something to feel proud of. But just because you're a diverse community doesn't mean you're an equal community. And that's certainly true of Oak Park. And of course, it's true of the entire United States. You know, we're talking about Oak Park, but everything that's going on in Oak Park, you know, is true of everywhere. I think one of the things that makes the series, I hope, more unique is that Oak Park, being such a liberal community with a very well-funded public school system and a diverse community, you know, it's the kind of place where one would hope that there would have been greater progress on these issues. But I think what the series, in a way, shows is that there are deep-seated reasons why change is so hard in this country, even under the best of circumstances.
I just had a conversation with one of your other Cartemquin colleagues, Bing Liu, about what it was like to have Hulu pick up his film after he did it. You all, after American to Me premiered at Sundance, Starz has picked it up for distribution. Do you feel like you still had to get it all funded? So I wonder, having all of these other outlets, if that makes a difference or it's making it easier to do the kind of work that you like to do.
One of the economics of series now, which is a good thing, is there's a lot of docuseries now coming out. And I think from a broadcaster standpoint, what's appealing about that is that you can, you get more bang for the buck for the money, if you will. You get multiple episodes of a series that then ultimately ends up being cheaper, you know, per hour, say, or minute even, than if they were buying a standalone documentary. And, you know, we are in the midst of an incredible golden age of television, and, you know, not only in the drama and scripted side of things, but now I think with documentary. And I think it just allows for a much more expansive, nuanced, and complex storytelling in the documentary community.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Steve James about America to Me. It's going to air on Starz starting this weekend, Sunday night at 8 o'clock. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is filmmaker Steve James. He is the director and executive producer behind a new docuseries that's going to be premiering starting this weekend on Starz. It's called America to Me. It's a 10-part documentary series about Oak Park and River Forest High School. Steve shot there's a handful of students in the 2015-2016 school year, and we've been talking about the issues of not just race, but education, and how this all has played out in his hometown. Steve, to the point of just the fact that these are deep-seated divisions, I think a lot of times we think about, and it's very interesting how you present sort of the policy side of this, which is there's an achievement gap, which even I was very amused by some of the Black kids who kind of make fun of this. Clearly, this is something they've been discussed in the school, that there's an achievement gap between the Black kids and the white kids. But there's a lot of really complicated reasons behind that. I wonder, was that part of why you wanted this to be a docuseries instead of just 1 2-hour film?
Yes. And though I have to give credit to the school board that approved the series for initially raising that very question, it came up in some of our discussions with them before they were going to vote on it. And they said, one of the school board members said, how are you possibly going to do everything you want to do in a single film? And of course, I made the joke that, you know, have you seen my films? They tend to be long. And they laughed, but I said, but more seriously, I think you make an excellent point. And I made a promise to them there. I said, I can't guarantee this, because we now, if you approve us to go forward, we have to go find funding, and finding a series is harder than funding a single film. But I said, we will make every effort to make this a miniseries, because I agree with that. And we were fortunate to find great partners in both the MacArthur Foundation here in Chicago, but and then much more significantly with the Participant Media, that allowed us to do just that. And you're right, it's sort of, you know, if you're making a 2-hour film, I think we would have been forced to either focus on 2 or 3 students, perhaps, which wouldn't have reflected the sort of wide variety of experience that the kids we were able to select did, or we would have had to have made it, you know, much less of following the stories of kids' lives and much more of a kind of, you know, issue-oriented documentary that's just focused on, you know, the sort of nuts and bolts of these issues, which is not something I wanted to do. It's not the kind of work I like to do anyway. Mm. So the series allows us to follow multiple storylines, including the school as an institution, as well as the kids and the families of the kids, and yet also have passages in the film where we become a bit more analytic about the issues.
Steve James is on the line with us from Oak Park, where we're talking about this docuseries, America to Me. And Steve, I think when you think about the demographics of Oak Park in the community, biracial families are a significant part of Oak Park and also of the student population at the school. And your work features not just biracial families, but students and teachers, and especially of Ms. Stovall, who's one of your main teacher characters. Do you think those stories are told enough in America?
Not at all, no. I think it is one of the profound demographic shifts going on in this country and maybe around the world as well. You're right. Oak Park is a magnet for biracial families. I read somewhere that we have something like 6 times the national average of biracial families in the community, which is pretty phenomenal. And that was why it was vitally important that we reflect that in the series as well. And so we have, you know, we have a black-white biracial family. We have a
black and Asian.
Mm-hmm. We have a black Asian, and then in part two of the series, we have a white Mexican family student who becomes a central character. And yes, I think the experience of being biracial in this country, there's so much more to be done with it. I feel like we do our best to really try to address the individual experiences of the kids we're following. And with Jess Stovall, the teacher you mentioned, she's an incredible story, I think, in the series, because she's someone who readily acknowledges that she grew up culturally white in a virtually all white community in upper Wisconsin. And she has, over the years, had to kind of learn how to be black. And now she finds herself in a school where being a black teacher has often been being lacking power and empowerment. Being a black woman in that school, they, you know, is talked about in the series as not being something that translates into empowerment, and which is, I'm sure, surprising to a lot of people and will be to them in the community. Mm. So she's really kind of gets it from both ends, in a sense.
And there's this heartbreaking scene with her where she talks about, I think it's an aspect we don't think about with teachers and violence, and how teachers, we hear so much about children and the impact of violence on children when children are killed or shot. But then she presents a really interesting side of teachers and the guilt that she grapples with as a teacher when she has a student who is a gang member who ends up being killed after he leaves the school. I think that's also an interesting aspect of violence that we don't hear very much about.
Yes, of how it impacts people that were in the lives of those young people in this case. And the guilt that she felt about maybe she didn't do enough, you know, to help. And I think that all, you know, she cares so deeply about the kids she teaches, and that shows up in every aspect, I think, of how you see her in this film. One of the kids that's a major character is Kashan, who is in her English class, her American Lit class. And he is a bright kid, a very bright kid, very funny, but not, for the most part, very engaged with doing school. No one in his family has graduated.
Which she very admits in a very charming way.
Yes. No one in his family has graduated high school, let alone college. His mom went to the high school and was basically kicked out of OPRF years earlier. And Jess will just not give up on Kashan. And as the series progresses, you see her get drawn more and more into his story and a kind of commitment to seeing him not just pass this class, but stay engaged in school.
I want to bring up another character in the series, the physics teacher, Mr. Podolner. And this is a longer clip we're going to play, but it's a conversation Mr. Podolner is having with two of his students, Charles and Jada.
You can take a class or you can teach black kids, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean like you necessarily know everything there is
sure.
about race.
Yeah.
That's what confused me about the memoir, because it seemed like you had like a conscience about race in America, mm-hmm. but it didn't reflect how you are in class.
When I see black students in my class, I kind of label it as an extra priority because I know what you guys have been with.
Okay, so I have an issue with that. Maybe you shouldn't, not saying like, oh, you should see us all as equal. Well, yeah, kind of. You should just see us as your students. So I was like, oh, this is my black student, so I'm going to have to check and jive with her and try to see if I can relate. And it's just like, it's based off of stereotypes.
I know that you've experienced racism, and I know you've been treated ways because you don't look like other people. So one of my goals, if I want to raise the achievement of my black students, which is significantly lower in your physics class, I have to do something so that they have the comfort level to be in the class. Now, the things I've done with you have made you uncomfortable.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
Like, yeah.
Right.
Because that can ruin my whole day. It can make me think about that for the rest of the day.
Right.
That, no, I think that's a no. Like a no-no. Like, you shouldn't do that.
You know, what you're telling me is kind of different than what we're hearing from our, quote, racial leaders at the school and administration. They're telling us we should talk about race all the time with all our students in every single class, not just like during the African-American, you know, History Month.
But when you guys talk about race in class, it is not serious. Race isn't serious. Like, you make jokes and stuff about it, and it's just like, that's what makes me really angry. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a sensitive subject that you shouldn't be, like, you know.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. It may be because I'm just a naturally joking person, but, like, with racism, it's like, yo, it exists, but some of it is kind of funny. Because with me,
no,
I don't...
No, it's not.
That's my opinion.
It's not funny.
I'm entitled to my opinion.
Oh, my God.
Just like you said. I feel like for me, I don't really care about it because if I don't feel like I'm directly being...
I feel like when you do that, you make white people comfortable to say stuff, and then it's just going to continue on and on and on and
Well,
on.
What have we been doing for
exactly,
100 and some
Exactly, because we keep...
Fam,
okay.
Bro, calm down. Look, if we gonna
should we
choose
talk
something,
more about
I'm
it?
Sorry.
Yes, let's continue.
It's nothing positive talking about race. It's nothing that you can be possibly happy about.
Right.
That's Jada, Charles, and their physics teacher, Mr. Podolner, at Oak Park River Forest High School. And that's from America to Me, the docuseries we've been talking about. Steve, just as we wrap up this conversation, I think that gets to some of the nuances of what we're talking about. And I wonder, for you, having spent so much time with these students, and as this being sort of the latest filmmaking effort that you've made that looks at race in America, what are you hoping people will take away from this?
Oh gosh, it's a 10-hour miniseries. There's a lot I would love for people to take away. I'm really pleased that you played that whole scene because I think you're right. It's a really strong and complex conversation going on there, because on the one hand, you have Mr. Podolner, who is incredibly well-intentioned. He had shared with both Jade and Charles, which he's done with other students in the past, his racial memoir of growing up in Oak Park and grappling with race. And it's a very candid account of what he was going through. It's the kind of candid, you know, account that you wish more, you know, white people would at least take on, right? That he does that, and he shares it with them and wants to hear their thoughts about it. And he gets along great with Charles, who comes in at the end of that scene to disagree with Jada some. He has found a rapport with Charles that is, you know, that is really works for both Charles and for Mr. Podolner. He has not found that rapport with Jada at all, clearly, and you get that from the scene. And what she's trying to say there is that not all black people are the same, right? And you can't – what may work for Charles – is not going to necessarily work for other kids of color when it comes to issues of talking about race and engaging with their education. And I think that's one of the fundamental things that I hope will come through in the series is that equity is not an easy thing to achieve, and it's not the same thing as equality. In other words, if you treat all black kids the same in an equal fashion, you're not going to get the same results. Black kids, just like white kids, any kids, they're individuals, and they need to be addressed and dealt with a kind of consciousness around race, but also as individuals. And I think one of the problems Oak Park has is that despite its great intention, its good intentions, as reflected by teachers like Mr. Podolner, it struggles with how to really meaningfully impact their education in positive ways, because there's just there's a lot of disconnect going on.
What kind of feedback have you heard back from people in the community about this far? I know it's going to be, you're doing some screenings you're going to be doing, you just did, and you will also continue to do in the community next week.
The sense I got is that the community, on the one hand, was relieved to see a lot of great things that the school is doing and great teaching that's going on in the school. And I think they were taken with the lives of the kids that we follow. They're, you know, they're kids that I think really you connect with and you're pulling for. They were also, at the same time, I think, bothered and rightfully so about some of the criticisms that are implied in there and strongly stated in those first couple of episodes. So, you know, I think it's going to be a really interesting journey. The school and the community are committing to once a week as this rolls out, watching the episodes and then coming together for conversations that the school at least hopes will be part of really making for more significant change that you know, in the school and in the community. And I hope they're right about it.
That's Steve James. America to Me airs on Starz starting this weekend at 8:00. As he said, there's a couple screenings in the Oak Park River Forest area. If you're interested in screenings, I know you're. If people are interested around Illinois, Cartemquin possibly could do that too, right, Steve?
Yes. So I have a website address that they can go to if they want to become part of impact and outreach around the series, which is AmericaToMeRealTalk.com.
We will put that on our website. We'll tweet it out if folks are interested. Steve James, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Mm-hmm. We're out of time for today. Do you have the NPR One app? You can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps, and you can always find past shows there. It's pretty simple to download. Then you set your home station. And if you search for The 21st to follow us, you can easily listen to past shows that way. We're also available wherever you get your podcasts. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.